National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Leo XIV has completed the first full week of his new pontificate, and there's much to report, much to discuss, and much to analyze. This week on Register Radio, we're joined by senior Vatican analyst and editor for the Vatican and EWTN News, Frank Rocca. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director for EWTN News, and delighted to join you once again from Rome as the new pontificate of Pope Leo XIV continues. I'm joined this week by, as I mentioned, Frank Rocca, who is a seasoned Vatican analyst, a seasoned Vatican reporter. And Frank, I want to talk to you briefly about your new role in just a second, but welcome.
Thank you, Matthew. Always good to be with you.
So you have something of a new title. So let's talk briefly about that.
Yes, I'm called Vatican Editor. So I'm overseeing a lot of the print content that comes out of the Vatican Bureau, the Rome office, in English. In English, of course, we have many multilingual services, but that's what I'll be doing in addition to occasionally weighing in like this and writing.
Well, you've been a Vatican watcher, Vatican reporter for how many years now?
Since 2007. So almost, it will be 20 years in a couple of years, hard to believe.
So hard to believe, too, that this is already your third pontificate, right?
Yes, that's true. It is. I mean, I was around when John Paul was Pope, but I really wasn't covering the Vatican. So this would be the third now, that's right.
Yeah. And the technology's changed, the popes may change, but the beat in many ways stays the same, doesn't it?
Right. I mean, the challenge is usually finding out if something really is unprecedented, because hardly anything is. But technology, certainly there has never been an encyclical on AI, we can be sure of that.
Yeah. So there is something unprecedented. It's hard to find them, I know, in the 2,000-year history of the Church. We have the first U.S.-born pope.
That's for sure. Yes, that's right.
So give a broad assessment so far of Pope Leo XIV's first week as pope.
Well, one thing that's it's inevitable at this stage in any pontificate that you would be comparing him with his predecessor, especially a predecessor so distinctive and so unconventional as Pope Francis. And it's pretty clear that he's, when it comes to symbolic gestures, he's gone back to tradition repeatedly, over and over again, starting with his choice of his name, which we talked about, I think, last week. Mm-hmm. He chose a name of which there had been 13 precedents, but also, you know, just wearing the mozzetta on the loggia. And last week, on Monday, he met the media, and we remember that in 2013, Pope Francis had not blessed the media because he said, "I'll give you a silent blessing because I know many of you are not Catholic," and that made some people happy and made some people very anxious. This time, Pope Leo blessed them in Latin. So that kind of thing has been happening, and there are a number of points of distinction. He has paid tribute to his predecessor on a few occasions, but I would say he's done pretty much what you would expect he would do. He hasn't. I wouldn't say that he's trying to suggest that this is Francis II.
Right. Including, it was noted last Sunday with the Regina Caeli. That was pretty distinctive. First, he came out onto the loggia the way he did, very dramatically, in white. But then the way he concluded it.
Well, he sang. Pope Francis was tone deaf by his own admission, and so he didn't sing in public. Benedict sang, although I don't think he sang the Regina Caeli on Sundays. Leo has I'm not a musician, but he seems to have a very nice voice, and he did sing.
Yeah, and it is noted too by Latinists that his pronunciation, his command of Latin, is more than impressive.
Right, and that's telling. I was even told, though we haven't verified this, that he had at some point celebrated the old Mass in private. But if that's true, the mere fact that he knows it would be notable given his age.
Right. So what are we to make then of some of his comments at the Regina Caeli and then throughout the week on some of the issues that he's inherited coming in as Pope? I'm thinking in particular of Ukraine.
Well, in the Regina Caeli, I mean, he called for peace in Ukraine, which is something that Pope Francis did incessantly. But there was a nuance. He said he wanted an authentic, just, and enduring peace in Ukraine, which is Pope Francis put the stress more on really peace at any price, because he said, you know, just you have to, everybody has to sacrifice. And he even at one point said that the Ukrainians needed to raise the white flag, which didn't go very well in Ukraine. And this week, he received, later in the week, he received the leaders of the Eastern Catholic Churches. And the biggest one, of course, is the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. And the hierarchy there, led by Archbishop Shevchuk, but not only, he had been at times pretty open about their frustration with Pope Francis,
right,
because of what they felt was that he was being too pro-Russian or not sufficiently pro-Ukraine. They seem much happier with Pope Leo.
And we know that he also spoke with Zelensky, the head of Ukraine, too.
That's right, that's right. Right out of the gate, he did a couple of things which could be seen as he talked with Zelensky, President Zelensky of Ukraine, and then he sent a public message of, or maybe it was made public, but he sent a message of friendship to Jewish leaders, specifically American Jewish leaders. And we know that in the foreign policy front, there'd been tension between the Vatican and Ukraine, for, as we mentioned, but also with Israel, because Pope Francis got used a pretty strong language, not only in support of the Palestinians, which is traditional at the Vatican, but he said at one point that the Israeli campaign in Gaza was terrorism, and even said they should be investigated for genocide, which are not words that, especially in Israel, are taken lightly.
Right. Yeah, now we had the a tweet or an X post that was deleted at some point by one of the officials of the Israeli government. How do you see that playing out? We have this new statement to American Jewish leaders, or to Jewish leaders writ large, but where do you think this could go in the early days of this pontificate with Israel?
Well, I suppose if Pope Leo might try to be a little more careful about not seeming to underrate the Israeli position or the Israeli arguments. I mean, it's true that Pope Francis always said, he always coupled his calls for a ceasefire with a call to release the hostages that Hamas had taken. He always did that, and Pope Leo repeated that. But I think it's pretty clear that he thought that the Israelis had gone too far. Maybe Pope Leo does too, but he seems to be wanting to make it clear that he values the relationship with Israel and with Jewish leaders.
Yeah. And in terms of his relationship with the U.S., I know it's very early days in terms of this pontificate, but this is going to be fascinating from a journalistic standpoint to watch, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it will be from many points of view. I mean, we remember that when he stepped out in the loggia, he broke into Spanish, he switched into Spanish, and he greeted his former flock in Chiclayo, Peru. He didn't greet his compatriots in Chicago, Illinois, and he spoke English the next day with the cardinals, but it was clear that he was speaking to international group that many of whom don't speak Italian. So I would have a hunch that he'll go to Peru before he goes to the U.S. But yeah, it was interesting also what emerged this week is that one of his brothers is a vocal Trump supporter. And so the Pope has already made it clear that he wants to defend migrants, which is some point of continuity with his predecessor. But it will be interesting to see how he makes those arguments. I suspect he'll make those arguments in a way that might be a little more appealing to Americans who are skeptical, more so than Pope Francis, who said that, you know, building a wall is not Christian, and was much more equipped to engage with the arguments of the MAGA people.
Yeah. After the conclave, the American Cardinals had a press conference up at the North American College here in Rome. Obviously, they're the center of study for American seminarians, and they were all, for the most part, living up there. And a number of the Cardinals were asked, I know, in questions, did Trump influence sort of this election for Pope Leo in one way or the other? And what were some of the responses, do you remember?
Well, Cardinal McElroy, who's the Archbishop of Washington, has been very critical of the Trump administration on this and on other points, said that he didn't think it weighed. It's hard to imagine that it could, because it couldn't have possibly been a positive. Well, I suppose the argument might be that, oh, we need an American to counteract Trump, but that seems a bit of a stretch, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think a conclusion that somehow the Cardinals were voting for him one way or the other, specific to Trump. But I know that they were asked, too, about how much of an obstacle was being U.S.-born, or the first American pope, in the conclave, something that may have caused hesitation. And I know Cardinal McElroy made the case that he was surprised that it did not seem to register much at all, that this was not something that the other cardinal electors were even factoring in. What were some of the reasons for that?
Well, I mean, it was said beforehand, whenever I then Cardinal Prevost's name came up, and I, to my chagrin, I underrated the sources who told me that to really watch him and to take him very seriously right up until the end. But the argument, it was always, you know, it was said, well, but he's an American, and people always said, no, they don't think of him as an American, they think of him as a Latin American, because he spent so much time in Peru. I guess it's true. I mean, I guess it, for anybody who might have had reservations about someone, the representative of the superpower, that seems to have diffused it. He's a very cosmopolitan figure. He's lived all over the world. He spent most of his adult life outside of the United States. But at the same time, he is very American. There's no question about it, and he doesn't hide it. So from what we understand, he speaks to at least one of his brothers all the time, very frequently. He goes back there. We have pictures of him, I think, from last summer visiting a pizzeria. He's wearing civilian civvies. He's not wearing clerical garb. And so it's, he's obviously very much an American, even though he's lived abroad. And I should add, I mean, to be an American, I mean, the stereotypical Yankee, I mean, the United States is that way a lot. There are a lot of multicultural people in the United States, both people who come from other places, of course, but also Americans who've traveled a lot and are married with people from foreign countries and everything. So I think maybe this will be a good opportunity for people to see the United States in a more nuanced light.
Yeah, and he might be exactly the type of bridge builder. I know at the NAC press conference, Cardinal Dolan made the point that we really should anticipate that he will be, as the name suggests, Pontifex, a builder of bridges between Latin America and North America, between Latin America and certainly North America and the United States and Rome. Is there a sense from your sources that it wasn't a reason necessarily for voting for him or electing him, but is there some sort of a repair work that has to be done certainly between the Holy See and, say, American givers and just sort of average American Catholics?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think the first thing will be interesting to watch is the relationship between the Holy See and the U.S. bishops. Of course, Francis had the certain bishops that were considered Francis bishops and Francis cardinals, but they were in the minority. The USCCB was not getting along very well with Francis. That's pretty clear. We know about the whole tension over Joe Biden and with the question of denying communion to Joe Biden or of censuring him in some way for his being, you know, as a practicing Catholic, but also a supporter of abortion, legalized abortion, abortion rights, however you want to say it. But that in the end, the Holy See and the Pope's allies, let's say, among the bishops, stopped that effort to try to put Biden on the spot. And they also wanted the bishops to change their public policy agenda, explicitly their statement that the preeminent priority was the struggle against abortion, which the bishops stubbornly stuck to. And I think probably still certainly reflects the majority view there. Now, maybe Leo won't have as much of a problem with that, or maybe he'll be more persuasive about, maybe he'll, dare I say, we'll have to see because he's just been around for a little while, but maybe he'll be more trusted on this score. And if the bishops feel that he's really not being, let's say, weak on abortion, I mean, I should say, Pope Francis was always very blunt in his denouncing abortion, but he didn't politicize it. He didn't seem to think, he suggested that it really wasn't a deal breaker politically. You know, if Leo is more reassuring on that score that, you know, Catholic politicians should not be supporting legal abortion, then maybe the bishops will be more inclined to say, well, okay, let's talk more about migration. They do talk about migration, but they make it as much of a priority. I don't know. That's very speculative, but I think that's the first thing. Beyond the bishops, I guess my hunch is that, you know, it is said, some people say that a lot of Catholic, conservative Catholics in the United States really resented Pope Francis's emphasis on economic justice, social justice, migration, creation, environment. I don't know if that's true. I think maybe there was more frustration, which was they felt he was de-emphasizing traditional moral teaching. Mm-hmm. So again, if Leo is seen as clear and strong on that, maybe it's no problem that he's resembles his predecessor on those other political economic issues.
Let's hold that thought for 1 second. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, your host. I'll continue my conversation with Frank Rocca in just a minute.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, and your host this week for Register Radio, continuing my conversation with Frank Rocca, Vatican Editor for EWTN News. And Frank, when we left off, we were talking about Pope Francis, American politics, and the issue of abortion. Pope Leo XIV gave a very impressive speech. We're recording this on Friday. He gave a presentation this morning to the diplomats accredited to the Holy See. And if I want to get your take on the broader speech, but he was very clear today, wasn't he, about unions of man and woman, and then also in raising the unborn.
Yeah, he did. That was striking. I was less struck by the reference to the unborn because that's a pretty consistent. Pope Francis also, you know, talked about the protection of life from conception, natural death, or formulae similar to that. But yes, that's true. He decided in a relatively short speech to diplomats, by the way, because Francis, and I think his predecessors too, used to give these long surveys of, you know, everything that was happening in the world. And now this isn't the annual speech that given in January to diplomats, so maybe Pope Leo thought he could just introduce himself in a more right. succinct way. So it's not a terribly long speech, but he did choose to emphasize that. And I think more remarkable for me is that he went out of his way to say that the family, he said the family is the, you know, foundation of society, but he said the family is founded upon the stable union between a man and a woman. You know, he didn't need to say that. He could have just said the family. So he wanted to reiterate, obviously a traditional part of Catholic teaching, but he felt he wanted to reiterate that, so we can infer from that what we want. But he also said something which I found even more intriguing still. He said, the church can never be exempted from speaking the truth about humanity and the world, resorting whenever necessary to blunt language that may initially create misunderstanding, end quote. Now that, I mean, and some scores, Francis avoided that blunt language.
Right.
You know, he especially on sexual morality, for mm-hmm. example, and homosexuality, where he famously emphasized the part of the Catechism that says that we should be compassionate and right. avoid unjust discrimination and so forth. But he didn't ever reiterate the parts about natural law or the prohibitions of sexual acts
or the phrase intrinsically disordered.
Well, he certainly moved far away. Now, it should be said, I don't think Benedict himself, who as Cardinal Ratzinger oversaw the doctrinal office and was responsible for that language about intrinsically disordered and so forth, which so many people find disturbing, I don't think he probably used it when he was Pope. I can't be sure. Mm-hmm. Popes are sometimes take a slightly more pastoral approach.
Right.
But it was pretty clear that Benedict, you know, about the same-sex marriage debate was going on when he was Pope, mm-hmm. and he was pretty strong against that. Francis didn't harp on those things, to put it mildly. So now, in this case, we're still in the realm of abstraction. In generalities, he didn't say what he wants to be blunt about. But you get a sense, especially since before he was Pope, Leo did speak bluntly about the quote-unquote homosexual lifestyle.
Right.
He spoke out against gay adoption and the promotion of these ideas in the media, also abortion, euthanasia. Mm-hmm. So the question is, will he go back to that kind of language now in 2025, post-Francis? That would be quite remarkable. He might be setting the stage for that or preparing the ground for that, because it's hard to imagine what else he could be. I mean, it could be other things, but what is it? What is this sort of blunt language he seems to be warning people about?
Yeah, it's something that obviously we're going to discover in the days and weeks ahead. But this has also been a remarkable week from the social media side. I know that he talked to all of us. We were in the room with him, with the media, but he also launched his own. He inherited it from Pope Francis, but all of the Pope Francis posts and social media for Instagram and X have been archived. The explosion of followers, though, is pretty noteworthy, isn't it, on both Instagram and on X for Pope Leo XIV.
Right. I was actually surprised. I don't remember precisely the transition from Benedict, because the X account then, in those days, Twitter, was launched under Pope Benedict. And I thought that when we went over to Francis, that it was a seamless transition, and I thought that the followers remained, but maybe not. In any case, in this case, they, as you say, they archived all of Pope Francis's tweets or posts, and they zeroed out the followers. So
right.
So Leo had to start from scratch, but he's making a very big comeback.
Yeah, let's just say this is a robust beginning. Oh, it's 17 million followers at this point, or
is
something?
Is it in all the different? Of course, there are all these different accounts. Some have more. There's a myth out there that he's the first one to have a Latin account. That's not true. Francis kept the Latin account too.
Yeah.
But he also shut down his pre-papal account on X, because then Cardinal Prevost had an account on X and was fairly active on it.
Yeah.
Of course, after his election, his followers went up to, I think, 500,000. But he didn't post. He hadn't posted since April.
Right.
Although some of his last posts had to do with politics and the. Mm-hmm. It should be noted that he followed some of the sister outlets of this program. I can't remember now, but.
I know in the past he would retweet the Catholic news agency
yeah.
on a fairly regular basis, especially. And what really stayed with me was that he would retweet some of the CNA articles on, like, the March for Life,
yeah.
pro-life statements. So he was very clear, I think, and has been consistently as a priest and then as a bishop. We can go back to 2012 when he was the head of the Augustinians.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about that in a minute, because there was an important story that you covered there.
Yeah.
But when he was tweeting, he mostly retweeted. But those were things that I think a lot of the pro-life Catholics are pretty excited about.
That's right. And it should also be noted that he retweeted some of the more progressive Catholic outlets on things like migration and criticizing J.D. Vance. But
right.
that's not surprising that he would hold that array of views,
mm-hmm. right.
which of course we're very familiar with, and is
yeah.
not there's no conflict there, certainly.
So in the time that we have left, I want to dig in a little bit about the piece that you did. Going back to 2012, when you interviewed him, when he was head of the Augustinians.
Yeah, in 2012, he was the prior general, I think is the title of the Order of St. Augustine. And he participated as a major superior in the Synod of Bishops in 2012. In those days, the Synod of Bishops was limited pretty much to bishops. That was pre-Francis. It was still Benedict. But he took part in that. And he gave a very quotable and a very provocative speech about how the mass media in the West promotes what he called anti-Christian lifestyle choices. Including abortion, euthanasia, but also same-sex marriage and adoption by same-sex couples. And he talked about how the church could respond to this. So it was very much what we would call now a culture war speech. It was very much of its time. But I went over and we interviewed him about that, but also about Catholic media and the media in general. And also then we veered off into other topics about the role of the religious life and comparing it to the ecclesial movements. So it was a very churchy conversation. I didn't know he would be Pope. I would have asked him about all kinds of other things too. He recorded his synod speech. I was then with Catholic News Service, which is part of the USCCB, the Catholic Bishops Conference. And he recorded that speech. We put that online, and that's also been getting some attention. But years later, I and a former colleague asked him if he still held those views. And it wasn't entirely clear. He suggested strongly that Pope Francis had taught us all to emphasize welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
So even for people, he said, who's no, regardless of their choices, people shouldn't be excluded because of their choices. But he also said doctrine hasn't changed.
Right.
He said doctrine hasn't changed. So the question remains: to what extent, will he resume this kind of discourse that was muted, let's say, during Francis, not only by the Pope himself, but the word went out, I think. People inferred that this was not the tack we should take about talking about the culture that hates us and promotes all these terrible vices. And he gave us another clue, as I think we discussed last week in his homily to the cardinals the day after his election, where he did talk about the culture and the society being very hostile to Christianity. Mm-hmm. So it's a hint, along with his comment a week later to the diplomats about blunt language, it's a hint that maybe we're in for a little more sharp talk than we heard under Francis on these issues.
Yeah. Well, Frank, very quickly, what are you working on?
Well, I'm learning the ropes as Vatican editor, and this is a very, very, as our listeners must know, this is a very diversified organization with operations all over the world, and it's learning to be an air traffic controller. So that's what I've been doing the last couple of days.
Well, have fun landing the planes. You're in a very exciting airport, so to speak.
Yes, yes.
What we see.
Yes, and we should note, underscore for people, that this organization is exceptionally strong in two countries, the United States and Peru, which makes us as well-positioned as any outlet could possibly be to cover this pontificate.
Yeah, not to mention here in Rome.
Well, there's that.
The Vatican, yeah. Thanks in part to you.
Yeah, the Vatican is part of the key part of the puzzle.
Well, Frank, thank you for everything that you're doing, and your arrival here in this new role could not have been more propitious.
Well, thank you, Matthew. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, thanks so much for joining me this week here on Register Radio. On behalf of Register Radio, on behalf of the National Catholic Register, also on behalf of my co-host, who has not been able to join us over these last few weeks, Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and our producer, Mike McCall. Please, until next week, take care. I'm Matthew Bunsen. God bless.